Bill Vandenhoevel, who is a counsel to the firm of Strook and Strook and Levine, belongs to the tradition of great New York lawyers such as Henry L. Stimson, Jack McCloy, Cyrus Vance, and happily for us, many others, who have deemed it their duty to give as much of their time and talent to their nation as to their clients. He has been a kind of latter-day Bernard Baruch, whose wisdom is sought by the great. He served as executive assistant to General Wild Bill Donovan, as special counsel to Governor Averell Harriman, and as assistant to Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He has been our deputy permanent representative to the United Nations and our ambassador to their European office. Arthur Schlesinger has told me that Bill, as co-chair of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, accomplished the seemingly impossible task of forging union and peace between the FDR Hyde Park Roosevelts and the Oyster Bay TR Roosevelts. Surely we should send the man who could do that to see what he could do in Israel. I give you Bill.
Thank you, Lewis, for that gracious introduction and for that new assignment. I shall leave. I'm very grateful to my Sanctuary colleagues for coming tonight, especially to those who came up to me to say that they often come to membership meetings but rarely stay for the speech, but they would tonight. And I shall never forget those many who came up and said they often come to membership meetings and stay for the speech, but they wouldn't tonight. But I certainly will be at the membership meeting next month, so I can hear an eloquent pacey of what I've said tonight, which will undoubtedly be much better than this. Now, I'm excusing the historians and the archivists from answering this question, but I ask my audience generally, who was the first centurion to be president of the United States? Do I hear an answer? No, Chester Allen Arthur. Chester Allen Arthur was the first member of the Sanctuary Association to become president of the United States. One admirer described him as the greatest social lion we have had in many years. But historians generally give mediocre marks to his abbreviated presidency. Succeeding to the White House in 1981 upon the assassination of James Garfield, 1881. I was foreseeing things. Arthur was an ardent New Yorker, and he had to read this appraisal of himself in the New York Times as he became president. Arthur, said the Times, is about the last man who would be considered eligible for that position. Did the choice depend on the voice of either a majority of his own party or of a majority of the people of the United States? Now, of course, the admissions committee of the Sanctuary may have had a different attitude. I've been unable to find any surviving letters proposing him or supporting his membership. But his reputation as a graceful, tactful man with a political talent for pacifying grand egos must have made him very welcome at the long table. Altogether, 8 centurions have been president of the United States. Chester Allen Arthur was the first, and Grover Cleveland was the second, and Dwight David Eisenhower was the last. And in between, the greatest political leaders of the 20th century gave stature to our association: Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, Herbert Hoover, and my subject for this evening, who probably is, as most historians describe him, the greatest president of the 20th century, but who is certainly and truly a man of the century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. On February 14, 1921, C.C. Burlingham, perhaps the leading lawyer and municipal reformer of his time, wrote as follows to a fellow lawyer with a nearby office at 52 Wall Street. "My dear Roosevelt, now that you are back in private life and in a suburb of your own hometown, I want you to join the sanctuary. Tell me who will propose and who will second you, and I will write them and tell them to do it." Burlingham's letter continues, "W.C. Brownell, the literary critic of Scribner's, was in the elevator in the New York Athletic Club the other day, and he heard one man say to the other, 'Did you ever hear of the Century Club?' 'Yes, it's down on 43rd Street.' 'What sort of a club is it?' 'It's a club of eminent men.' 'Now, ain't that a hell of a club? Sincerely yours, C.C. Burlingham." The next day, FDR wrote to Burlingham and accepted the invitation, writing that he felt very highly honored, for in spite of the remark that the man in the elevator made, there is only one Century Club in the world. And on February 16, 1921, Burlingham sent FDR the club book so that he could mark out the members that he knew well enough and then leave it to Burlingham to ask a proposer and a seconder to do their duty. Among those that FDR marked as known friends were George Blagden, William Chadbourne, Frederick Coudert, Augustus Hand, Thomas Lamont, George Putnam, and Robert Greer Monroe, whom Mr. Burlingham chose as FDR's proposer. John Milburn, who was the senior partner of the law firm where FDR had apprenticed himself, agreed to be his seconder, quote, "because I know him well and am very fond of him." It was in Milburn's home in Buffalo, New York, that President McKinley died, and that Theodore Roosevelt had taken the oath of office just 20 years before. FDR was certainly familiar with the sanctuary before he became a member. In May 1921, for example, he was a guest of Edward Bach, the creative and business genius of the Saturday Evening Post and the Curtis Publishing Company, whose son, by the way, Curtis Bach, a judge of the Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, wrote the famous decision allowing Ulysses to be published in the United States, and whose grandson, of course, Derek Bach, was president of Harvard University. Edward Bach gloried in his success, having come to the United States as a 14-year-old immigrant boy from Holland, and he used that meeting at the sanctuary to found the Netherlands American Foundation with the purpose of advancing mutual understanding and active exchange between the two countries. Because the Netherlands had been neutral in World War I, and because Queen Wilhelmina had given reluctant sanctuary to the defeated Kaiser, the normally warm and cordial American feelings for the Dutch were under pressure. And the Roosevelts, all of them, were directly descended from Claes Martin van Roosevelt, who came from the province of Zeeland and the nation of the Netherlands in 1648. FDR always took great pride in his Dutch forebears, and at the sanctuary meeting, he agreed to be vice president of the foundation. Franklin Roosevelt was elected as a centurion on January 14, 1922, at the monthly meeting of the association. He was elected at the same time as a non-resident member, Hiram Bingham, the Yale professor who discovered Machu Picchu, the ancient Inca kingdom in Peru, and who then later served 8 years as United States Senator from Connecticut. Many of us knew his son, Jack Bingham, who was a member of Congress, and his son, Stephen, who was a vice consul in Marseille and made possible the dramatic mission of Varian Fry in helping the refugees out in 1940. At this point, FDR was 39 years of age. He'd been married for 16 years. And when Franklin married Eleanor in 1905, the President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, gave the bride away, his niece, and dominated the event by his presence. There was probably no one whom FDR admired more than Theodore Roosevelt. He cast his first vote for Theodore Roosevelt. And the extraordinary parallel of their careers was undoubtedly influenced greatly by that admiration. Consider these parallels. Both TR and FDR, separated by a generation, were elected to the New York State Legislature, T, T.R. at 23, Franklin at 28. Both were appointed Assistant Secretary of the Navy, T.R. at 39, F.D.R. at 31. Both were vice presidential candidates, T.R. at 41, F.D.R. at 38. Both knew political defeat, Theodore Roosevelt as a candidate for mayor of New York, and in his Bull Moose candidacy for the presidency in 1912, and FDR in the Democratic primary for the Senate in 1914, and as the running mate of James Cox in the 1920 presidential election. Both married at a young age, TR was 22, FDR 23. Both had four sons as brave participants in two world wars. Both were Harvard graduates, and most significantly, both were members of the Sanctuary Association. On September 7th, 1923, FDR, as a new centurion, agreed to write a letter in support of the nomination of Minot Simons, the pastor of All Souls Unitarian Church, whose pastor is still a member of the sanctuary today. That was the church where FDR's parents had been married in 1880. But then on December 15th, 1923, Franklin Roosevelt writes the board of the sanctuary an abrupt and a clearly painful letter. He feels obliged to resign. I am doing this only because I am spending most of my time in the country at present and feel that I cannot avail myself of the privileges of the association for some time to come. Of course, what had happened was that FDR's life had been transformed by debilitating disease and illness. In August 1921, at the age of 39, Franklin Roosevelt had been stricken by infantile paralysis. It was an ordeal that many believe gave him the courage and the character to become a great president. But the path to recovery was a tortured one, with many crises of despair and of anguish. He suffered acute pain for many weeks. There was considerable question whether he would ever be able to sit up again. In 1923, he chartered a houseboat and spent weeks cruising in Florida, swimming in the warm water that relieved the pain and gave him hope for his weakened legs. The expenses and the strain of the extended convalescence mounted. He was confident that he could learn to walk again. It became the focus of his life. His forays into public places were carefully planned. The magnificent deception that had begun that kept his significant disability a personal, private matter. Two-thirds of his personal fortune, about $700,000, went into establishing the Warm Springs Foundation in Georgia. He transformed it into a major treatment center for polio victims. He created an enterprise that is today one of the most successful rehabilitation centers in the country. And of all the triumphs and defeats that Franklin Roosevelt ever had, probably the triumph that he would have savored most had he lived was the announcement on the 10th anniversary of his death in 1955 by Jonas Salk of the discovery of the vaccine that has put an end to the plague of polio as those who lived before that time understood it to be. In 1924, Governor Alfred E. Smith asked FDR to nominate him for president at the Democratic National Convention in New York City. On the arm of his son, FDR, with his legs firmly locked in braces, holding a cane in his other hand, advanced slowly, without crutches, to the podium in Madison Square Garden. It was a moment that no one who saw it would ever forget. His palpable courage, his lyrical eloquence, his magnificent voice brought the delegates to their feet. And at that moment, Franklin Roosevelt resumed a national political career. Some years later, after his polio attack, he was elected governor of New York, and 11 years later, president of the United States. As Frank Friedel, one of the important Roosevelt biographers, has written, Roosevelt had so perfected an illusion of his strength and well-being that most Americans never realized until after his death that he was, in fact, a paraplegic. On December 17, 1923, in response to FDR's letter of resignation, The secretary of the sanctuary, A.D. Noyes by name, wrote him a personal note expressing the hope that he would reconsider his action. He obviously did reconsider, because on June 5, 1924, with Elihu Root, Theodore Roosevelt's Secretary of War and Secretary of State presiding, the Board of Management passed the motion acceding to Franklin Roosevelt's request, quote, for transfer from the resident to the non-resident list. And so the Squire of Hyde Park, the farmer from Dutchess County, and of course, the future governor of the state, the president of the nation, Franklin Roosevelt continued as a non-resident member of the sanctuary until his death. When he became governor of New York in 1929, FDR was frequently asked to write letters for support to support candidates. A gentleman named H. Morton Merriman, a neighbor of Roosevelt's in Campobello Island, was such a candidate. Someone, Archibald Douglas, wrote FDR asking for a supporting letter, saying, I know that such a letter will go very far toward ensuring Mr. Merriman's election. For unstated reasons, Merriman's name was held up by the admissions committee. So Governor Roosevelt had written a letter in his support, but it was a pro forma letter. Still unconvincing, I might add, as one reads it today. Archibald Douglas asked him to write a letter again for fear that Merriman would be passed over. And he did write a more extensive letter, leaving out his earlier point that Mr. Merriman was head of an important silk company, and concentrating instead on his interest in African exploration and his extensive knowledge of public affairs and the fact that he was secretary of the New York Memorial Cancer Hospital. So Mr. Merriman was finally elected a member in 1931. On April 5, 1929, supporting the candidacy that had been seconded by Colonel Edward House, Woodrow Wilson's confidant, of Judge Robert Worth Bingham of Louisville, Kentucky, FDR wrote that the judge was an old friend of his, and I should be very glad to see him elected to the Sanctuary Association. And of course, after his election to the presidency, Judge Bingham was FDR's choice, first choice to be ambassador to the Court of St. James. And of course, Judge Bingham's newspapers and the Bingham family itself became synonymous with great journalism. Pulteney Bigelow wrote the newly elected governor asking him to support the nomination of Dr. F.F. Day, the new president of Union College, citing the fact that FDR's father had graduated from Union College in 1847, which should be reason enough to be admitted to the sanctuary. Other letters of support were written by Roosevelt for Francis Riggs, who was a Grattonian, as Endicott Peabody reminded him in asking him to write the letter. And he supported another neighbor in Hyde Park who was an amateur ornithologist. And he supported a professor at Barnard College, and then a cousin, Copley Amering. Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated for the first of his four terms as president on March 4, 1933. Whether it was the careful filing system of his devoted secretaries, Missy LaHand or Grace Tully, or his own predilection as a collector to save what others might find valueless, there are a considerable number of notices from the Sanctuary Association that are part of the records at the Presidential Library in Hyde Park. A fascinating profile of our cherished Sanctuary Club emerges from these documents. For example, in the notice of the monthly meeting for November 1, 1934, it's reported that 142 breakfasts were served in September. Now, when we combine that information with a club notice on April 1936, we have echoes of a contemporary debate. The notice of that date told the members that Columbia University had extended room privileges to all of the members of the sanctuary. The Columbia University Club was across the street. What is now the Mooney Hotel was the Columbia University Club. And so let the Board of Managers take note. Rooms with a bath were available for $3 a day. Suites were more expensive, $5 or $100 a month. But single rooms could be obtained for $2 a day, no bathroom. There was an exhibit at that time of Italian paintings of the Renaissance. Consider this. Including works by Piero della Francesca, Botticelli, Bartolomeo. There are notices of memorable names being elected to the membership such as Tom Finletter in 34, George Wharton Pepper in 36, as well as Archibald MacLeish, Lord Lothian, later British ambassador to the United States, Lewis Douglas, later Harry Truman's ambassador to Great Britain. The club celebrated the 75th birthday anniversary of Walter Damrosch in 1937, and in the same year had a memorial service for Elihu Root, who had been a member of the club for 51 years and president of the sanctuary for 9 of those years. Nelson Rockefeller was elected in May 1937, and also in that year, Dean Acheson, Alan Dulles, and Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, who was nominated by Admiral Richard Byrd and seconded by the sitting Chief Justice of the United States, Charles Evans Hughes. In 1938, a reception was given to honor Mr. Justice Van Deventer, a recently retired member of the Supreme Court of the United States. Honoring Justice Van Deventer was undoubtedly a means of showing the disdain of many centurions, including Charles Burlingame, for President Roosevelt's Supreme Court reform proposals. There's reason to believe that the prevailing sentiment of the century did not favor the New Deal. On June 8, 1938, Bice Clemo, a centurion with admiration for Roosevelt, wrote him a letter which included this refreshing insight, quoting, "Yesterday in the Century Club, I eavesdropped on two graybeards who were gleefully, but you can bet damn furtively, reassuring themselves that Roosevelt's got them on the run now, and exchanging pleasure over your chin-up spirit and continued excellent health." Mr. Clemo's letter continues, "The circumspect sanctuary trembled. I'm almost certain down to the frayed magnifying glass which hangs from the telephone book. But there must be black sheep in even the most august woolly flock." Roosevelt, of course, was delighted by the report. He rollicked in his political enemies. You may remember the great speech he gave in Madison Square Garden in 1936 when naming the enemies that he had to face in that election, the economic royalists and others. He looked them, no, that was 40. But in 1936 in Madison Square Garden, he said, "My enemies in the last 4 years have met their match. And in the next 4 years, they will meet their master." That's the way. In the most controversial legislation of his presidency, FDR proposed that when a federal judge, including those on the Supreme Court, reached the age of 70 and chose not to retire, that the president could add a new justice to the bench. By the winter of 1935, the Supreme Court had become the last hope of those who were committed to blocking the New Deal. FDR's concept of the constitutional powers of the President and the Congress to cope with the Great Depression, much closer to that of Theodore Roosevelt, but very different from that of FDR's Republican predecessors, who had in fact appointed the dominant majority on the court. The anti-New Deal forces literally started thousands of legal actions to stop the fulfillment of programs which the President had initiated, that the Congress had legislated, and that the people in landslide elections had approved. The court invalidated the Railroad Retirement Act. It overturned the NRA, as well as the mortgage moratorium legislation. It ruled the Agricultural Adjustment Act unconstitutional. And Harlan Fiske Stone, former Dean of Columbia, appointed by Coolidge to the court, wrote a dissent accusing his colleagues of deciding on the basis of their own economic theories rather than on constitutional interpretation. The court proceeded to overturn legislation designed to bring order and safety to the coal mining industry. It overturned the Municipal Bankruptcy Act, created to save local governments across the country from financial distress. And then it ruled unconstitutional the New York State law, establishing minimum wages, outlawing child labor, and regulating the hours and labor conditions affecting women. Even some of the opponents of the New Deal thought perhaps the court had gone too far. FDR waited for the election returns of 1936 before acting. He was reelected, of course, with an overwhelming landslide. The court was about to decide the constitutionality of the Social Security Act and the Wagner Act. It was a dramatic moment in our history. Would the economic and social revolution enacted by the elected representatives of the people be defeated? Not at the polls, but by a court whose majority philosophy the people had decisively repudiated? Would it now return the demand for change to the anarchy and to the violence of the streets? The conservative radical justices who dominated the court, though aged and in declining health, were determined to stay in office as long as Roosevelt was president in order to frustrate his programs. But Roosevelt took great comfort in reading these words from Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural. Said Lincoln, "The candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by the decisions of the Supreme Court, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. Having to that extent practically resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal." Echoes, echoes. Roosevelt had enormous respect for the constitutional framework of the balance of power, for the integrity of the Supreme Court as an independent branch of our government. But he stood with Lincoln in rejecting the concept that the Constitution was a rigid, inflexible instrument that could prevent the government from responding to crises that threatened to destroy the nation. He presented his court reorganization proposal on February 5, 1937. Within weeks, under the pressure from Chief Justice Hughes, also a centurion, the court reversed its course, upholding the Wagner Act and the Social Security Act, and even reversing itself in just a matter of months on the New York State minimum wage laws. Most of the reorganization proposals, by the way, despite common thought, were adopted by the Congress, including the provision that obliges federal judges, other than those on the Supreme Court, to take senior status at the age of 70, so that the president, whoever he or she may be, can appoint new justices to the bench on which they serve. Wendell Willkie, elected to the sanctuary on December 5, 1936, having been nominated by John W. Davis, wrote, "Mr. Roosevelt has won. The court is now his. He has accomplished exactly what he would have accomplished if Congress had passed his legislation." As World War II approached, the sanctuary reflected the profound division between those who believed that America's national security and its values as a nation required it to support the forces and the democracies in the battle against Hitler and the totalitarian armies besieging the world, and between those who were part of the America First movement, who devoutly believed that involvement in European wars could only endanger democracy itself. As the Nazi conquest of France in June 1940 shook the world, FDR decided to run for a third term. Now his opponent was another centurion, Wendell Willkie. In 1912, three centurions ran against each other for the president: Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson. In 1932, Roosevelt had run against another centurion, Herbert Hoover. The political balances were shattered when still another centurion, Henry Stimson, Secretary of State under Herbert Hoover, accepted FDR's offer to be his Secretary of War. But partisan politics were set aside as centurions with strong beliefs about our international obligations determined how best to influence the course of action being determined by their non-resident colleague and present commander-in-chief. There's a memorandum in our archives by Beth Webster, a wonderful lawyer of other days, detailing luncheon meetings in the sanctuary beginning in May 1940, which resulted in the organization of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, a major organization in terms of America's history, which was led by centurions Vannevar Bush and James Conant, then president of Harvard. Centurion Robert Sherwood has written of frequent meetings at the sanctuary in the summer of 1940 with a group that became known as the Fight for Freedom Committee, which advocated interventionist policies. The Committee to Defend America by Aiding the Allies had a strong Centurion identification, beginning with its chairman, William Allen White, a non-resident member who was editor of the Emporia Gazette of Kansas. Our beloved colleague, Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., has described these momentous days in a cogent and eloquent address now in the Sanctuary Archives. By the way, when William Allen White first came to the Sanctuary for lunch, William Dean Howell, who was his sponsor, brought him to the table and said to him, "Now, I don't want you to think that we get our name from the average age of our members." Francis Pickens Miller, a noted Virginian and a Centurion, writes in his memoir that his association with the Sanctuary Group in 1940 gave him a chance to do what was probably the most useful work that he had ever done, in addition to having made possible the most satisfying experience of his life. He describes the event of that fateful summer, what it meant to be an American and have some part in turning the tide against tyranny. Mr. Miller's role, along with Lewis Douglas, Herbert Agar, Dr. Henry Sloan Coffin, Whitney Shepherdson, Henry Van Dusen, and others, was to affect the political climate that enabled the president to carry out the desperately needed transaction, which gave the British 50 overage destroyers in return for long-term leases on military bases in the Western Hemisphere. Now, some of those Centurions were certainly for their friend and colleague, Wendell Willkie. Some were for FDR in that election. But they were all deeply conscious of the fact that there were national and international interests that transcended the partisan interests of the day. Roosevelt was, of course, a consummate political leader. In one situation, I've heard tell, a group came to him urging a specific course of action. He replied, "Look it, I agree with you. I want to see done what you do. Now make me do it." He understood that a president doesn't rule by fiat and by unilateral commands to a nation, that he must build up some political support that makes his decisions acceptable to our countrymen. He read the public opinion polls not to define who he was, but to determine where the country was, and then to strategize how he could move the country to the objectives that he thought had to be carried out. The summer of 1940 was a presidential campaign. The president needed the support of Republicans and Democrats before he could carry out the destroyer transaction to save Britain. He also needed to be assured that Wendell Willkie wouldn't use it as a political issue against him. The Sanctuary Group decided that the most effective spokesman for their point of view would be General John J. Pershing, the revered commander of the American Expeditionary Force in Europe in World War I. But reaching the aged general and then convincing him to make the radio address to the nation was a challenge with hair-raising episodes and frequently bizarre circumstances. But the Centurion succeeded. And on August 4, 1940, General Pershing made a national broadcast, written by another Centurion, Walter Lippmann, supporting the destroyer transfer to Great Britain. That speech was regarded as the turning point in the effort to create the public support for the president. The all-important question of the constitutional powers of the president to carry out that transaction also had to be answered, and a brilliant memorandum was prepared by Ben Cohen, who asked several of the country's most eminent respected lawyers to examine it as a basis of a letter to the New York Times. Of course, they all turned out to be Centurions. The letter, a decisive intervention in public debate, was published in the New York Times on August 11, 1940, signed by Dean Acheson, Charles Burlingham, Thomas Thatcher, and George Rubley. One final step had to be taken. There had to be an assurance from Willkie that he would not attack Roosevelt for carrying out the destroyer transaction. The political stakes were very high. The Republicans could have energized the isolationist voters who already were discouraged by Willkie's internationalism. And the chairman of the Sanctuary Group, Lewis Douglas, was one of Willkie's most ardent supporters and trusted advisors. So a telephone call was arranged between Centurion Archibald MacLeish and Russell Davenport of Fortune magazine, a leader of Willkie's campaign. And Davenport gave the needed assurance from Willkie as he sat in the room. Roosevelt announced the destroyer transaction on September 3rd. It was a historic moment publicly turning the tide forever so that the United States turned away from isolationism to active participation in the struggle for the democracies against tyranny. In 1940, with Europe under Hitler's heel, U.S. military strength ranked 17th in the world behind Portugal. Isolationist sentiment remained powerful and was fully reflected in the Congress. The destroyer deal helped save Britain's lifeline from the unremitting attack of the German submarines. Hitler called it a belligerent act. It was. Roosevelt proposed Lend-Lease. He announced the Four Freedoms as the goal that would justify the terrible sacrifices that lay ahead. He met with Winston Churchill. They announced the Atlantic Charter, the blueprint for the survival of democracy. And together they created the partnership that we hail today as probably the most important political partnership of the troubled 20th century. All this, and America was not yet at war, but America's isolationists could no longer prevail. Roosevelt's third term victory decided the direction of the nation. On March 28, 1941, less than 5 months after the election, FDR's notable and noble opponent, Wendell Willkie, spoke at a meeting of the Century Club. A Centurion friend wrote Roosevelt describing the Willkie speech as one of the most unusual occasions in the entire annals of the Century Association. Willkie told his fellow Centurions that he was going to do everything he could to build a strong public sentiment behind the country's foreign policy so that the man who beat him for the presidency would, quote, become the most famous occupant of that office since George Washington. The packed library trembled with cheers and applause. Willkie became FDR's emissary to Winston Churchill. He toured the globe, wrote his immensely popular book, One World. But for his untimely death in October 1944, at the age of 52, Willkie may well have worked out a political partnership with Roosevelt that would have realigned the political forces of the country in a way that would have given a solid, continuing base to the internationalist liberal values that both men advanced. Franklin Roosevelt's last known communication with the Century Club was on June 10, 1944. He had been asked to write a supporting letter for Edward Stettinius, then Under Secretary of State. Roosevelt chose instead to call the chairman of the Admissions Committee to tell him Stettinius was a good man who would add greatly to the values the Century Association cherished. Eric Larrabee, a friend and cherished reminder for many of us in this room, while president of the Century Association, wrote a majestic book about Franklin Roosevelt entitled Commander in Chief. In it, he tells the story of Roosevelt and Churchill being together for the Casablanca Conference in January 1943. As the conference ended, Churchill persuaded Roosevelt to go with him to Marrakesh to watch the sun go down on the Atlas Mountains, a favorite site of Churchill's. Finally, the time came for Roosevelt's departure from Marrakesh. At 7:30 in the morning, a ghastly time for Churchill, he came to the airfield wearing his black velvet slippers, his blue flannel coverall, and his dressing gown topped off by the head of a field marshal of the Royal Air Force. Churchill said goodbye to the president and then turned to Kenneth Pendar, the American vice consul who had driven him to the airport, and said, "Come, Pendar, let's go home. I don't like to see them take off." The sun was breaking through the ground mist and the outline of the mountains was beginning to appear. And Eric Larrabee writes that the aircraft, though large by the standards of the time, must have seemed tiny in all of that vastness. In the car, Churchill put his hand on Pender's arm. "If anything happened to that man," Churchill said, "I couldn't stand it. He is the truest friend. He has the farthest vision. He is the greatest man I have ever known. How proud we can be that Franklin Roosevelt was a man of the century.
Thank you.